For me, first and foremost, it's all about the people. Leadership is all about people. And I truly believe that an organization can only be as good as the people that it's got and how well they work together as a system. And this focus on people is fundamental to my approach to leadership.
Hey everyone, it's great to be talking to you again, and thank you for joining me for episode 24 of the show. And what an episode it is. Today we are lucky to be joined by Richard Moriarty, who has been in post as the CEO of the UK's Civil Aviation Authority since May 2018. He's been at the helm through some truly unprecedented times for the aviation sector, with things such as the drone attacks at Gatwick Airport, a number of failed airlines, and the need to coordinate the largest repatriation operation in history since Dunkirk. And of course, let's not forget the impact that COVID-19 has had on the aviation sector as a whole. There are so many fascinating insights and pieces of actionable advice from Richard in this episode that I just kept recording for longer than usual so as not to waste the golden opportunity we've all got to learn from him. And he is a truly exceptional leader. To quote Richard directly, he says at least once that a lot of his current leadership approach comes from the school of hard knocks. And to quote one of my favorite proverbs, the wise man learns from his mistake, but the wiser man learns from the mistakes of others. So, having really built this episode up for you, let's not delay any further. Please enjoy my interview with Richard Moriarty, CEO of the Civil Aviation Authority. Hello, Rich, and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing today?
Yeah, good morning, Ben. I'm doing very well. Good to be with you.
Good to have you on the show. So I thought I would start off this morning because it's a slightly different podcast to normal. So for the benefit of everybody who is listening, we're recording this on a Sunday morning. It's about 10:30. And actually, it's the first Sunday in the second national lockdown here in England. So if there is such a thing in 2020, Rich, what does a typical Sunday morning look like for you?
For me, Ben, it normally involves going for a run in the morning and then trying to convince my partner, Emma, not to pack out the day with so much that we end up getting disappointed by the time we get back. So I imagine we'll go for a nice walk, take the girls out on their bikes to burn off some energy. And if I can get a coffee along the way and generally relax before getting stuck back into work this evening and tomorrow morning, that would be great.
Sounds like a brilliant Sunday and fairly similar to mine, I think. So, Rich, again, for the benefit of everybody listening, the first question I always like to ask guests is another context one, really. So can you just tell us what the current role is, what you're doing at the minute, and a little bit of the backstory or the career journey that got you there?
Yeah, sure, Ben. I'm currently the CEO of the UK's Civil Aviation Authority. This is the body in this country that's responsible for regulating and overseeing the aviation and aerospace industry, particularly in terms of its safety, security, financial oversight, and how it treats consumers and the public. We also support the development of new technologies and innovation in aviation and aerospace. But the backstory as to how I got here, like a lot of executives, is a little bit convoluted with a couple of sort of detours along the way. In terms of education, I studied economics at university, undergrad and postgrad, and I did an MBA whilst working earlier on in my career. But near the start of my career, I actually started out with the Foreign Office and worked for them. But I was never cut out to be a career diplomat for reasons that will probably become apparent. I then moved to work with various regulators that were set up by the government at the time, really to oversee the privatization and the liberalization and the reform programs that were happening to some of the big industries at the time: gas, electricity, Royal Mail, social housing. Economics and finance and reform in markets has really been my career anchor. But I've also worked in the private sector as well as director of one of the regulated water companies. But naturally, as you move to more and more senior positions, technical expertise and functional anchors tend to take a second place, or they certainly have for me, to a much more sort of broader leadership and general management set of skills and functions. And towards the end of, I think it was 2014, I came back to the public sector to become chief exec of the body that oversees the regulation of all lawyers in the country. That was my first chief exec role. And from there, I was fortunate enough to move and become deputy chief exec of the Civil Aviation Authority. I think it was in 2016, and then assumed becoming chief exec a couple of years ago. So that's really how I've come to my current position.
Wow. And Rich, are there any particular lessons that you learned from your time in the Foreign Office? What particular lessons or skills did you pick up there that have served you well as a leader? Because that's quite a unique background. And certainly, I don't think I've had any guests on the show who've had that background. And I suspect I probably won't find too many others in the future who have. So I'm just intrigued to understand a little bit more about kind of what you took away from that particular point in your career.
Yeah. I think it was the importance of relationships and the importance of relationship management. But I mean, obviously that's stock in trade for the Foreign Office in terms of diplomacy and British influence abroad. But actually, I think those lessons do extend to business and they extend to life more generally. And I try and bring that approach to my senior management roles. And really, in most of my roles have been in what you might describe the knowledge economy. And in terms of my leadership approach, I would draw out a number of points, which hopefully your listeners might find of interest. For me, first and foremost, it's all about the people. Leadership is all about people. And I truly believe that an organization can only be as good as the people that it's got and how well they work together as a system. And this focus on people is fundamental to my approach to leadership. I think secondly, leadership for me is not about being the best personally. It's about making others better. Any leader who thinks it's about how the team makes them look good, I think is fundamentally wrong. My approach is to inverse the pyramid. It's about what you can do as a leader to make the team excel, not the other way around. And I think thirdly, what I've learned is that IQ and technical expertise tends to get you only so far. Leadership really does require other forms of intelligence. It requires people to have emotional intelligence, spatial intelligence, relationship management, if the output of the organization is to be greater than the sum of parts. So I often joke in my organization that IQ is an overrated commodity. It's the other stuff that I need to make the organization excel. The only other couple of things that I would add that I've sort of picked up along the way is it's really important for any leader and organization to have a clear sense of purpose that unites people across the organization in whatever role they do, whether they be the most junior person in the organization or the most senior. It's really important that they know how they contribute towards a bigger and more exciting vision. And then the final point, which I've learned perhaps in the school of hard knocks and from my mistakes as much as my successes, is culture can break your strategy. But strategy can very rarely break your culture. It's really important to understand the culture and be purposeful about the values and behaviors you want to drive performance and strategy. I think too often people spend all their time on strategy and planning whilst hoping the culture will just fall into place and allow for execution. But as one management theorist said, and I forget who it was, but it's really stuck with me, culture eats strategy for breakfast. And that's certainly been my experience along the way, Ben.
Yeah, I think it's a great quote. I think it might be a Peter Drucker quote, but so many quotes get attributed to Peter Drucker when they're not necessarily his, right? But that might be one of his. And Rich, there's two things in there that I scribbled down as you were talking that I'd love to ask you a few questions on. The first one is this piece around relationships. And sort of, you think you said that was one of the lessons you learned from your time in the Foreign Office. How do you go about sort of developing and building those relationships? More specifically, how do you do that when you are starting out in a new job or a new MD position? Do you have a particular approach or strategy that you follow?
Yeah, it's not a particular strategy, and it's not what I would describe as a scientific method. But when I approach a new job, I try and work out for myself who the key stakeholders are, who the key people are that I need to engage with. And I tend to take an approach which is, you know, engagement with folk and building relationships is of value for its own purpose. You know, too many people, I think, approach relationship management and engagement because they think they have to or they think they need to. But actually, it's often a way of forming creative partnerships which really allow the business and the organization to excel. So I'm quite purposeful about working out who it is that I need to engage with, asking them questions and listening to them. I think too many senior leaders are very prone to go on broadcast mode, but actually, as our mums always used to teach us, you know, we've got two eyes, two ears and a mouth, and we need to use them in those proportions. And I think particularly when you arrive in a new job, it's really important to listen and try and gauge what the expectations of key stakeholders are, not least because it allows you to form some creative partnerships. It also gives you currency in the bank to spend when times are difficult and you need to spend that capital.
Yeah, that's great. And Rich, was there a particular moment for you where sort of the value of really investing in and developing those relationships, partly just for the sake of the relationship, as you said, where like the strength and power of that really became clear for you? And the reason I ask is, I think for many leaders or many people stepping into their first senior leadership position, it can be very easy just to prioritize the task or doing the doing, if you like, which can often mean that we end up leading in our spare time when we have time, and the leading people element can easily slip to the bottom of the list. Spending time developing those relationships can easily slip to the bottom of the list. I wonder, what was it that sort of really brought that home to you and enabled you to act? Or was it just something that sort of fundamentally part of your DNA, your values, your character?
It is definitely the latter. It is part of my character. It's part of, if you like, my authentic approach to leadership. I always think that if you try to adopt too much of a mask or auto-ego in leadership, it will show up in tension and inauthenticity at some point soon. So it is part of me. It is part of my character. Having said that, Ben, I am always amazed and quite humbled that no matter how good ideas I think I've got to solve a problem, when you involve others, particularly those that have an interest close to the coalface in solving those ideas, you get two things. You get a much broader range of creative ideas, first and foremost, and also you get buy-in. In terms of execution, you get much more traction involving people in solving the problems. I mean, I've seen so many organizations that sort of spend their time, you know, 80-20. 80% of the senior leaders are spending their time on, you know, strategies and plans, and only 20% on execution and implementation. I would actually argue the road to success is paved by reversing that and really harnessing the talent in the organization as part of that problem solving.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the quickest ways to demotivate somebody or to disengage them is to give them the task, tell them exactly what needs to be done, tell them exactly how it needs to be done, and then sort of overly critique or criticize what they then produce or deliver, right? People just start to think, well, if you're going to tell me what to do and how to do it, why didn't you just go and do it yourself, right? I had to stop myself from swearing then on my own podcast.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's not a successful, in my humble opinion, Ben. I mean, obviously, different industries will have their different context, and I get that. But if you are increasingly working in the knowledge economy, you're dealing with people who value knowledge, who value creativity, who value a bit of autonomy. I appreciate you've got to have some structure and governance around that because, you know, you can't have anarchy. But a command and control and micromanaging task orientated leadership approach, it might get you results on day one, but I really don't think it's going to position you to excel in the medium and longer term. particularly given how uncertain the world is.
Yeah, absolutely. Rich, taking an ever so slightly different tack now, I just wonder, throughout your career and leadership journey, are there any particular leadership models or frameworks that you've picked up along the way and you found particularly useful that stayed with you? Is there any sort of principles, mindsets that you adopt and use?
Yes, a few, Ben. I mean, in looking at markets and positioning organizations for the future, and doing a bit of sort of strategic planning, if you like, you know, I often use the standard templates of PESTEL analysis and horizon scanning and Michael Porter's five forces. I mean, they're good as far as a very broad framework is concerned. I mean, perhaps it's a quirk of, you know, my current industry being so disruptive and uncertain, but I'm not a great fan of the traditional linear 5-year sort of strategic planning. Yes, you've got to have a plan and you've got to have a sort of financial plan that sort of backs that up. But I don't think you can be a slave to it. I think it's really important that you're ambidextrous. On one hand, you've got one eye on a 5-year sort of vision and plan. But on the other hand, you've really embedded agility and resilience to respond quickly to unanticipated opportunities and challenges. You know, I remember what Darwin said, you know, it wasn't the strongest or the most intelligent of the species that survived. It was the one that was most adaptable to change in the face of uncertainty. And I think, again, a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations that I've seen get the balance wrong between that sort of ambidexterity between, you know, planning and remaining agile. And the other thing I would say is strategic planning is not the same as strategic thinking. The former is a process and tends to be quite sort of rational, analytic, whereas the latter tends to be sort of informal, creative and agile and a bit more spontaneous. And I think in any organization, around any sort of executive team, you've got to have a blend of the two.
I'd love to ask you a couple of questions on that piece you just said there, Rich. Again, in my work that I do, coaching and developing senior leaders, or maybe I'm running a development program to prepare people to step into their first director level role. One of the challenges that I often hear is when the organization is telling them, we need you to think more strategic. We need you to be more strategic. The retort to that is often something along the lines of, that's great. I'd love to sit and horizon scan, but I just don't have time. There's just so much execution or doing that needs to be done. So what's your view on that? How have you found the time yourself to think strategically and horizon scan? What do you do within the Civil Aviation Authority to enable those that you lead to do the same? How does that work for you and the organization on a very practical level?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I would recognize that lament from a lot of managers and execs, which is, if only I had time to be more strategic, because the day job and the tasks take up far too much of my time. And there's no playbook, I think, Ben, for this. I think it is a common issue in whatever organization you're in. My sort of, if you like, coping mechanism that I try and put in place is, first of all, to try and force some horizon scanning. So we do dedicate certain days where the executive gets together to do purposeful horizon scanning and also answer the so what. It is very easy to sort of do a PESTEL analysis, but actually converting that into the so what will change as a result? What are the two or three inflection moments for our organization that we as an exec team need to get our arms around? You know, answering that question is really important. I mean, structurally, it's important to do this as well. I do believe that having a small team or a number of people that are tasked with, you know, their job is to think longer term. It is important. I appreciate not every organization can afford or can structure itself in that way. But I think also it's important that the senior leaders recognize that it is important that people have a balance between the short and the longer term. For me, it's about delegating a lot of stuff. It's about asking myself, what are the things in the organization that only I can do? Because if someone else can do it, and particularly if that someone is more junior than me, why aren't they doing it? why aren't I giving them that empowerment and growth opportunity? So really ruthlessly ask the question, what is it that only I can do that no one else can do? And how can I add value? But I certainly wouldn't profess to have a playbook. I know it's a lament of everyone in sort of, you know, mid to senior management positions, but it is really important to get right. Otherwise, if we just focus on the task, you know, eventually the world will overtake us.
Yeah. And how frequently and for how long do you bring your exec team together, Rich, for that horizon scanning exercise? Because a lot of people listening will say, this is great, but like, tell me what to do. What's the tactic? What's the routine? What do I need to put in my diary? So I'm just keen to get a little bit granular on that one.
Well, yeah, our exec team at the moment is meeting quarterly to do this, you know, with a whole day.
Right.
And I also, you know, a few sort of devices that I tend to deploy, the agenda has to be longer term. What you can't do is sort of mix and match and say, oh, yeah, we'll take that short term issue on that horizon day. Otherwise, the mindset isn't quite right. I also, for me, try and capture people's attentions by saying that electronic devices have to be on the floor, because actually, if someone's presenting and we're having a discussion about the future, if you're tapping away on your screen or your BlackBerry or whatever, then you're not giving it your undivided attention. So I do tend to take quite a strict line with participants in these sessions, that they come with an open mind, they come prepared, but also whilst they're there, they give it their undivided attention for a day.
Yeah, that's incredible. I'll share this in the show notes for everybody listening. There's some research I stumbled upon about a year ago that I'd share widely now. I forget the exact time, but it's either 21 or 23 minutes, which is the amount of time it takes somebody to fully focus back on the task they were doing prior to being distracted by a beep, a ping on their smartphone or tablet. Which, if you then sort of start to work that through, you think, well, in an average meeting, conversation, an average kind of day working away at our desk, well, how much of our working day really is fully focused on the task at hand? Like probably not a great deal when we're really in that deep concentration flow state, right? And I'm not anti-technology. I'm a massive fan of kind of the power of technology, but I think it's about using it intentionally rather than constantly reacting to it.
It's also, Ben, if I may, it's a way that I can also assess the quality of my leadership, because I think it's important if you're in a senior position, not only are you good at your vertical brief, but actually you've got a horizontal responsibility to the whole organization. And clearly, you know, the more senior you are, the more that horizontal piece is important. I mean, people often talk about T-shape leaders or T-shape managers. And you would have seen, I'm sure, you know, management teams where, you know, they're very vertically focused, but not very horizontal. So for me, it's really important to use those days to say to people, you know, this is a horizontal day. You know, you come here to really help me and co-invest in the future direction of this organization. So there's an element of using these days also to harness and develop future talent.
Yeah, I love that. That's fantastic. And Richard, if we could rewind a couple of questions. You started to touch on resilience and agility, and I'd love to ask you a few questions around that from an organizational and a personal perspective. So knowing you a little as you do, I think you've probably been CEO of the Civil Aviation Authority through some pretty testing times, right? With the collapse of Thomas Cook and the pressure that created. There was the drone attack at Gatwick Airport in the UK, I believe, and now COVID. So with all of that as the backdrop, what does resilience really mean to you? Let's start off personally. What does resilience mean to you personally? And what strategies or tactics do you use to ensure that you've got the health, the energy and the focus to lead the organization effectively?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Ben. I mean, we've had, you know, unprecedented times in aviation over the last couple of years, and you know, a lot of big challenges, some of which anticipated and some of which have been unanticipated. For me, it's about not being overawed by the challenge in front of us, but actually stepping up and asking the question, what is it that we need to do that only we can do to help position our organization and the industry to get through this. And trying to work out a sense of mission. You know, what's the answer to the question, do the right thing? You know, what is the right thing to do for this? So when we had the drone at Gatwick, we had to work through that. When we've had a couple of airlines fail, we've tried to assess what the right thing is in terms of bringing people home from abroad and making sure they're treated well. So it's making sure there's organizational confidence not to cower in the face of challenge, but to actually step up and face that challenge. And also a sense of mission, a noble cause, which is given that challenge, what is success going to look like for us? And then narrate that vision through the organization to try and galvanize people behind us. I mean, obviously, for me personally, a lot is around making sure you have rest and recovery. So many crisis management, and it does tend to be crisis management in aviation. The great wonder is that people run to it. They really want to do their best and they end up working 24/7. But very quickly on day three or four, there's a big collapse because people can't work at that tempo and pace for long periods of time. So you've got to have a rota. You've got to work at a different tempo and make sure that you've got a resourcing framework that really, really works, not just in terms of physical labor and making sure you've got bums on seats, but it's also about psychology and people's well-being. You know, some people are really good in a crisis and some people aren't. You know, I've seen some exceptional leaders crumble in the face of a crisis. I've also seen some people who became heroes in a crisis, which hitherto I never, ever would have thought possible based on what I knew of them in the business as usual. I think also when you're working hard, you're working under pressure and the chips are down, it's really important to have a strong team and a cohesive team around you. Petty politics and all of that stuff has just got to be left at the door. You've got to have a laser-like focus on the mission, the noble cause at hand. You worry about the post-mortem afterwards and you just do the right thing. So there's some of my coping mechanisms, as well as, dare I suggest, quite a bit of practice in aviation.
Yeah, right. Again, on a very practical level, what do you do, Rich, sort of before a crisis or when things are ticking along normally, in inverted commas, to make sure you're prepared sort of physically, energy focus wise when a crisis hits? And when you're in the midst of a crisis, are there any particular things that you ensure that you do to look after yourself? You mentioned the tempo and rest and recovery. I just wonder if there's any very sort of practical things, like are you a napper like Churchill? Do you make sure no matter what you always get 7.5 hours sleep? Do you make sure that even if it's a really intense period of work, you're still going out and getting some exercise? Just people are always curious, again, to know these very sort of tactical things that senior leaders do.
Yeah, for me, it's really important to eat and sleep. I know that sounds really simple, a motherhood and apple pie, but you know, I start to break down as a human if I don't sleep well or I don't eat well. And particularly with crises that are going to go on for quite a period of time, it's really important to maintain the batteries because otherwise you'll start to make poor judgments and you'll start to get cranky and that cohesiveness around the team is going to start to fray. And it's really important in an organization that you don't have a hero complex when it comes to crises. It's very easy for people to, particularly the most senior person, to feel that they've got to put the cape on and only them can solve the issues. You know, my one learning point in crises, particularly in aviation, is enroll others in that pursuit. You'll be really surprised that, you know, they will give their passion and their energy to help you. So what we tend to do in a crisis is really, really empower people. And what I say to them is, I'll support you. You just do the right thing and I'll support you come what may. So we break hierarchies and we put people right on the front line. And generally, you know, they get a lot of sort of experience from it. But I would counsel other people to avoid the sort of hero complex that comes with facing into a crisis.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. Fantastic advice. Rich, I think I've got one more sort of long form question before maybe finishing with a few quick fire ones. So again, for the listeners, obviously we know each other a little through our daughters being at the same school. And I think I recall a conversation we might have had over dinner or on a doorstep, kind of exchanging children from a play date or something, where you said you try to, I think you might have said you're pretty good, or that might be me putting words in your mouth. But anyway, the theme of the question is, I get a sense you are pretty good at switching off from work, disconnecting as much as you possibly can in the evenings and the weekends. And again, in a similar way to some leaders struggle with having the time to think strategically, I think many leaders struggle to switch off and disconnect and have this sort of always on, always connected, always checking emails, always responding. And I get a sense that that's not you. I just wonder, like, is that true? Have I got that right? And if so, again, like, how on a fairly practical level do you manage that?
Yeah, I mean, it is more or less true. That in the evening and the weekends, I turn my notifications off and I don't, after a certain hour in the evening, check in to my work email account. That's not to say I don't receive text messages and phone calls if it's really important, and that's fine. But I do tend to switch off, you know, particularly as I sit down for family meals and Friday evening. And therefore, you know, it must be a call or a text and something important that gets my attention. I should say that it's taken a while to get me into that place. In my early career, I was driven a lot by, you know, what psychologists call the imposter syndrome and the insecurities that come with it. So I was always trying really, really hard to prove to myself that I sort of belonged in a certain role. And also, you take responsibilities very seriously. I mean, particularly when, you know, in my current role, you're responsible for aviation safety. You know, it's something that the public and everyone would expect that, you know, you absolutely take really seriously. But I think it's important that as a leader, I've got people around me and it's a team. It's not just about me. You create a system that is much stronger than any particular individual. So when I go on leave, Ben, I delegate to one of my directors who has all of my responsibilities and powers, so to speak. And obviously they can call me if they wish to talk something through, but they know that I will back them for any decisions that they take in my absence. So yes, I've got to a much better stage at switching off. It's taken me a long time to get here. But it's also important for my well-being. I think if I went back to the sort of 24/7 constantly worried about the phone vibrating or pinging, I don't think I would be as good as chief exec as I can be, because I would just lose focus.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, Rich, let's finish up with a few slightly more quickfire questions. First one is, which is a new question I've started asking, from a leadership perspective, what's the one thing that's keeping you up at night, or if you're actually literally not struggling to sleep, from a leadership perspective, what's the one thing that's really occupying a lot of your thoughts and brain power at the moment?
It's, what is it that I can do to evolve the culture in the organization? There are parts of the culture of the organization that needs to modernize and improve. But as you know, culture change is not something that you do quickly or on a whim. So how can I be purposeful about moving in the right direction and bringing people with me whilst ensuring I've got a cohesive team around me? I think it's very easy for internal culture change programs for them to be labeled as, if you like, the chief exec's vision or pet project or whatever. And I'm a great believer to avoid the cult of the CEO. It's all about the organization. It's all about a broader group of people and embedding that change in the hearts and minds of a broader group of people. So a lot of my thinking when I go to bed is in that space at the moment.
Got it. And what are the one or two books that have really had a big impact on you?
I really enjoyed a book by Dan Ariely. It's called Predictably Irrational. And it's about how humans and groups and organizations, despite being very clever, make irrational decisions. And it really blows apart this notion that people make rational decisions if you go through a rational process. It talks a lot about cognitive biases, both in individuals and groups and organizations. And it was quite a powerful book for me in terms of, you know, how I harness decision-making capabilities within the organization. And then the other book that I've read more recently is by a guy called John Blakey, and it's called The Trusted Executive. And this really resonated with me because it's how do leaders encourage folk to trust them and move forward and change. You know, you've probably heard enough from me to know that shout at people and just tell them what the vision is not my approach at leadership. I'd like people to trust me and think that I'm authentic in what I do. And that book about the trusted executive just gave me a number of sort of helpful hints in that pursuit.
Brilliant. And what are you reading about, learning about, or curious about right now?
Well, pure escapism, Ben. I'm using the lockdown to learn a new skill, which is repairing and maintaining bicycles. And I'm okay at some of the simple stuff. I'm a bit nervous about some of the more advanced stuff. But it's my way of just giving me something to focus the mind on during lockdown, which is not work.
Well, if you get good at it, I might, as we said before we hit record, I might drop my bike around for you for some repairs as well.
Pleasure.
And final question to wrap up with then, Richard. What one piece of advice would you give to somebody stepping into their first role as a managing director or CEO?
Have the courage to be authentic to who you are. Too many of us put a mask on, particularly as we get our first managerial or executive roles. And we try to be the people that we think people want us to be, you know, superhuman, don't make mistakes, don't show any weaknesses. I think that's outdated. And I think it leads to tension. Be who you are. And, you know, if that means showing your softer human side, I think you will gain greater dividends through relationships and people wanting to trust and follow you than if you try and be inauthentic. So have the courage to be authentic and be who you are.
That's fantastic. And I think everybody listening will by now really start to have been seeing that as such a strong theme that nearly every guest has shared this piece around authenticity, the journey to understanding who you really are as a leader. You touched on it as well earlier on about imposter syndrome earlier on, which many people have touched on, and trying to be somebody or something that they're not. So what a fantastic piece of advice to end on. Richard, thank you so much for your time today coming on the show. It is a Sunday morning, kind of, which makes me even more grateful for you giving up a chunk of your weekend. There's absolute gold dust in what you've shared. There's certainly a lot of food for thought for me personally in there, and I just know it's going to be the same for everybody listening. So once again, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Not at all, Ben. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. There you have it, folks. My interview with Richard Moriarty, CEO of the UK's Civil Aviation Authority. I think the main thing that really stood out from this interview for me was Richard's focus, and I think in some ways a ruthless focus, on just doing the basics brilliantly well. Whether that be listening more than you speak, whether that's ensuring he eats and sleeps and rests and recovers well, especially during crisis management, whether that be truly enrolling others in the mission or the task at hand, or simply ensuring that all of his exec team place their electronic devices on the floor during their meetings so that they are fully focused on the person that is speaking. But there was just so much of value in this episode that, if I'm being honest, I've struggled to summarize it for you. Do also remember to take a couple of minutes to check out my new online personal leadership mastery program that's designed to help all of us play our best in a fast-paced, complex, and uncertain world. i.e. the world that we all find ourselves in right now. The programme brings together a collection of the very best tips, techniques and templates to help leaders at all levels reach peak performance. For a one-off license fee, you can access over 3 hours of videos and more than 15 toolkits, models, PDFs and downloads. I must say I'm really proud of this content and I hope that you'll see it as a great opportunity to boost yourself and your colleagues and get ready for whatever the year ahead throws at us. I've also included a 30% discount code for you in the show notes as a thank you for being a fan of and supporting the podcast. That's it for this episode, folks. Stay safe, stay well, and lead on.